Good afternoon, TGP. It's Monday, August 9th, 2021. This is In the Know. Well, I hope everyone had a restful Sunday. God was incredibly gracious to us yesterday as we gathered together as the church, and he graciously allowed me what I needed to get through the sermon, and almost literally only that. I spent most of the rest of the day in the bed. By his grace, I'm feeling much better today, and I'm ready to get started. No new announcements, short of just that we have life groups continuing to meet, and it'll be especially so and especially important as we get into the fall semester when school kicks back off and everything like that. Don't forget that when the newsletter comes out, there'll be a Bible trivia question with some prize drawer prizes at stake, so you can go check that out there. Also, I'm going to have a lot of links today, and it may be that you want to read this when it comes out. But let's go. The first thing that I didn't get to talk about, this is like, okay, well, two of these things, I got four things to talk about. Two of these things are things that I talked about that I just want to reiterate. And then two are things that I just didn't get around to yesterday. And that always happens. I mean, isn't that crazy? A 45-minute sermon, and I feel like I scratched the surface of this text and of the issues that it raises. But the first thing is the angel of the Lord. Who or what is the angel of the Lord? Well, let's break down that phrase. Angel means messenger. And maybe you thought angel means a particular type of spiritual being, but at its root, that word means messenger. Now, there are certain spiritual beings that are also called by this title. I think about the way that sometimes we will call a tissue a Kleenex, but there's also a brand of tissue called Kleenex, and I think it's something similar to that. So we could rightly call any messenger of the Lord an angel, but then there's like this brand, if you will, called angels. There's a particular type of being that they deliver divine messages and are called angels. Okay, but in general, an angel means a bearer of a message, and like I said, usually associated with a divine message. So angel. The Lord, and I've said this a number of times the last several weeks, the Lord is the English stand-in for God's covenant name, Yahweh. So in essence, this is Yahweh's angel. It's his personal messenger. The language is straightforward enough, but it's the biblical narratives themselves that seem to obfuscate or confuse the issue. The identity of this character is shrouded in mystery. Part of the reason it's so mysterious is that at times it appears that this being is distinct from Yahweh, and at other times it seems like it is Yahweh himself. Genesis 16 represents the first appearance of many of the angel of the Lord in the Bible. As with the figure named Melchizedek, so it is with this character. There are many theories about his identity. A man named Don Stewart over at Blue Letter Bible has an article that looks at some major theories, and he considers the evidence and then renders his own judgment. What I want to do is list out his three options here. If you're interested in further reading, go check it out at the link, Who is the Angel of the Lord in the Old Testament? He says some contend it's like just an angel, albeit it's a special representative of Yahweh that is different and distinct from the other angelic or spiritual beings in the Bible. Now, there are some who believe it's a pre-incarnate Christ, perhaps like bodily, physically there, or perhaps coming as a vision. And there are some who believe it's perhaps a manifestation of God the Father in a bodily form or as a vision. And honestly, sometimes it's just hard to tell. The reason there are so many theories is that no one theory seems to satisfy all the available evidence. It seems like at times it is God or some manifestation of God and his character, his person. And at other times, it's hard to imagine that it's God, but it rather seems like an angel. And so I'm not going to give, you may be wondering, what does Zach think about this? I'm not going to tell you my thoughts about it. I have some thoughts, but I hold them loosely. I'll let you do your own research on that and come to your own conclusions about it. If you want to talk about it more, I'm willing to talk about it with you. Now, while I wouldn't uncritically recommend everything from the Bible Project, as I wouldn't from anywhere or anyone else, I do believe they do a good job trying to untangle some of these knots. And more importantly, they get to how and why this matters. I really appreciate how they discuss this character. They say that this seems to be an intentionally ambiguous and complex character. And I just want to give their three conclusions as to why this ambiguity and complexity matter and how this figure helps us. And so you can do some more reading on that. I've also got the link in the newsletter. But they say, number one, this figure helps us to make sense of Jesus's claims. And the particular claims that he made is are that he is one with the Father, even as he is not the Father. So how can you be distinct from God and yet be one with God? And so this figure, who seems distinct from Yahweh and yet seems one united with Yahweh, helps us make sense of those claims in the Old Testament. Number two, they say, this figure creates shelf space for understanding the Trinity. How can it be that the Son is God and is distinct from God the Father and God the Spirit? So it begins to place categories in your mind so that it can then fill them out later. And then three, this figure helps us to know God's character more. So if you want to read this whole article, you can find it on Bible Project's website. It's called Who is the Angel of the Lord? Whatever the case about this figure's identity, what we can know for certain is that Yahweh's angel represents Yahweh himself. He speaks with the very authority of God. To have seen this figure is likened to seeing God himself in the Old Testament, even as Hagar says, I have seen him who sees me. So when this divine messenger finds Hagar and speaks to her, he speaks the very words of God on the authority of God, and he manifests the character of God to her. God has taken special notice of her and has expressed his kindness and grace to her, as well as given her a command and a promise. What grace! One verse I really didn't touch on yesterday at all was verse 12. And the reason is not anything other than it just didn't, it wasn't part of the theme that I was trying to draw out, that I think the narrative itself is teaching us, but that doesn't mean it's unimportant. And I want to kind of give you some of the importance actually of verse 12 today. So if you remember back, we read it yesterday, but I just didn't mention it. It's right after the angel tells her, you'll name him Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your cries. And then he says, he will be a wild donkey of a man. He will dwell over against his kinsmen. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. It says something like that. I don't have the scripture right in front of me. I was just trying to quote it as best I can remember. So part of this promise and prophecy about Ishmael appears to say that he's going to be a cause of strife to those around him or for those around him. The progressing narrative of the Old Testament bears this out. He does cause trouble, especially for the covenant family. So I got three ways this happens. So if you remember Genesis 37, when the brothers of Joseph all of the brothers, this is the people of Israel. These are the first, the namesake of the 12 tribes, Jacob's sons. They sell Joseph to Ishmaelite traders, Genesis 37, 28. Then later in the biblical narrative, in 2 Samuel 17, Absalom, now that's David's rebellious son who tries to take the kingdom from David. Absalom sets a man named Amasa over his army. And Amasa is born from, you guessed it, an Ishmaelite father. So in this rebellion against David, you have someone descended from Ishmael who is actually working against the God-anointed king over his people. And then in Psalm 83, specifically, you look at verse 6. The Ishmaelites are listed as one of the enemies who conspire against God's covenant people. If you read that list, it's a group you really don't want to be associated with. It's almost a who's who of all the baddies in the Bible. Philistia, Amalek, Moab, Edom, Ammon. Ishmaelites are included in there. They, like, this verse came true throughout the Old Testament narrative. But if you step back and you look at the present day, Ishmael still causes trouble for the covenant family. Islam came from Ishmael. You just do a quick Google search, Ishmaelites and Muslims, and that'll confirm what I've just said. It seems that the dominant claim in Islam is that Ishmael was the legitimate firstborn, so he should have been the rightful heir, that status of firstborn, but also physically the first son of Abram, and that Isaac is actually the illegitimate son. He should not be the heir. So they believe their lineage more accurately traces back and connects them to Abraham and Abraham's worship of God. Talk about unintended consequences. Abram and Sarai's mistake still affects the world today. God has indeed made Ishmael into a great nation in keeping with his promise in verses 10 and 11. But verse 12 has also come to pass. His hand is against everyone and everyone's hand is against him. He continues to cause trouble and strife for the covenant family through the false religion of Islam. I want to list some of the big parallels between Genesis 16 and Genesis 3, which I made mention of yesterday. Commentator Dale Davis says that Genesis 3 casts its shadow over this entire account. I like that way of saying it. All of human experience is in the shadow of Genesis 3, but this particular account almost reads like a separate fall for Abram and Sarai. Eve saw the fruit in Genesis 3:6. Then she took some of the fruit and gave it to her husband. Here in Genesis 16:3, Sarai came up with a solution, and she took Hagar and gave her to her husband. There is nearly a word-for-word equivalence between Genesis 3:6 and Genesis 16:3. In Genesis 3:17, when God gives his judgment to Adam, he begins with, "Because you have listened to the voice of your wife." Here, it is the exact same wording. Abram listened to the voice of Sarai, his wife. Also, there is a passing along of blame in Genesis 3, from the man to God and his wife, when he says, "It's the woman that you gave me." So from the man to God and his wife, and from the wife to the serpent. Here, Sarai wants to pass blame to God for their childless condition and therefore the, quote, necessity of their sin, and then to Abram for going along with the plan she concocted. In Genesis 3, after the sin, Yahweh comes and finds the couple and asks them questions. Here, he comes and finds Hagar and asks her questions. In Genesis 3, where there is a gracious promise made in the midst of sin and judgment, so it is here in the midst of the unfolding chaos, turmoil, and hardship of this sinful situation. God makes a promise to her and shows himself as gracious. Likewise, the intra-family strife resulting from sin is present in both Genesis 3 and Genesis 16, 1 through 6. You see that in Sarai's desire to usurp Abram's authority, to take leadership, and then her desire to manipulate him to action by shifting the blame on him. Then her mistreatment of Abram's, quote, other wife. I could probably go on further, but hopefully this suffices to convince you that Genesis 3 has its fingerprints all over Genesis 16, which is why it's also appropriate for us to insist that God and his grace are the only real, effectual answer to this terrible situation. And in my closing appeal yesterday, I mentioned what you might do when your difficult circumstances don't appear to line up with God's promises. I hope and pray that it did not seem trite or as though I were offering some silver bullet to cure suffering. Let me be clear, therefore, that there is no silver bullet to making things like death feel okay or less painful. Matter of fact, I think something's probably out of joint in our hearts if we don't grieve death and suffering. My point in this plea was to help you understand that when everything is taken away from you, when the bottom absolutely falls out from under you and everything you know is shaken, you can and must cling to the promises of God as you would to a piece of driftwood when your ship has sunk. It's your only hope. At times, these will be the only things that keep you afloat. As the minutes build up into hours, that build up into days, that build up into weeks, months, and years of suffering and pain, you don't walk away from or outgrow the promises of God, but you cling to them, never letting go and giving God no rest. And I mean that in a good way, as in we're persisting in prayer. You continue to pound upon the doors of heaven with your prayers, and you cry out to God to show himself moment by moment to your heart as trustworthy and faithful to these promises he's made. In other words, faith persists in prayer, believing exactly what Hagar experienced, that God hears, cares, and will act on your behalf. You plead with him for open, clear, spiritual insight into what he's doing and into his nearness to you. And you never let go of these promises until he proves himself true to the very last one as he brings you to himself fully, finally, and forever, either when he comes back or he brings you to himself. God's promises and our faith in God's promises are meant, they're made, they're custom built to help us reorient ourselves even as we pick up the pieces of broken, devastating situations. At times, God's promises will give us comfort in suffering, and at other times, it will feel as though they are almost mocking us. Just ask Sarai, who was barren but promised a son. But the point is that faith perseveres. Faith continues to believe the promises even when everything seems to contradict him. Maybe especially when everything seems to contradict them. Faith does not look elsewhere for fulfillment. It cries out to Yahweh, who sees and who listens and who is true to his word. So Alan Ross says that whenever God or his representative speaks, we begin there to discover the meaning of a passage. So when the angel of Yahweh names Ishmael and explains his name, it clues us into the meaning of this whole story. Abram and Sarai should have believed what Hagar experienced. It's as if the author is saying, imagine how they might have gotten to know God in the midst of their disorientation and suffering if, like Hagar, they had simply fallen on their faces and cried out to him. And how might he have shown them his grace? Of course, God is gracious, and so Abram and Sarai will still see the fulfillment of his promise to them in spite of what they've done in Genesis 16. It's not conditioned upon their works, but it's by grace through faith. But that shouldn't stop us from using our sanctified imaginations to say, if Hagar got to see God's grace toward her anguish, couldn't the same thing have been available to Sarai and Abram? And couldn't the same experience of the true and faithful living God who sees me be available for me? Indeed, it is, every single day. I pray you encounter and come to know the living God who sees you more today than you did yesterday. Have a great week. I love you, people.